This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to bbc.co.uk/radio3.
In London, in the early 19th century, the lamplight by which you read your newspaper, or ate your dinner, or strolled down a smog-shrouded Piccadilly, was fuelled by whale oil from Tasmania. As often as not, the odd-scented orange flame had its origins in a modest seaport on the southernmost rim of the world. To reach this port from England required a journey that took up to 8 months in a sailing ship, to a hilly town beyond the seas, in the words of the judge who might have transported you there in the event of you having committed a felony, as had the majority of Hobart's population. So voracious was our appetite for its oil, to read and to eat by, and to venture out into the metropolis at night, that the foundation of Hobart had to be put on hold in order first to harpoon a whale. In 1803, the British government commissioned a Boston whaler, Captain Ebor Bunker, to land 260 European settlers and convicts on the island of Van Diemen's Land, as Tasmania then was known, fearful that the French might claim it first. Bunker interrupted his mission when his ship encountered a spout of water jetting up out of Great Oyster Bay. The saying, "Lay me on, Captain Bunker, I'm hell on a long dart," became a popular cry in Hobart Town, which swiftly established itself as the capital not only of Britain's exported convicts, but of the South Atlantic whaling industry. Sperm whales and southern right whales packed the River Derwent opposite Hobart in such dense numbers that it was reported you could hop across their backs from one bank to another. In the nostrils of London, 14,000 miles away, Hobart stank every bit as bad as the putrid carcasses that Captain Bunker and his successors rendered into fat on the wharves opposite Salamanca Place. Hobart, then for some reason part of the Diocese of Calcutta, another ocean away, was recognised as the cesspit of the empire. Reports and fables of depravity and cannibalism sometimes made of Van Diemen's Land a synonym for all kinds of terror and dread. In myth and in history, the island's capital, Hobart, stood for the opposite of its illuminating whale oil, a dark Antipodean hull that was a byword for remoteness, like outer space on Earth, and invoked by those at the so-called centre to stand for all that was far-flung, strange, and unverifiable. But that judgment was made mostly by people who had never been to Hobart. The crime writer Agatha Christie visited the town a century later, and her experience was compellingly different. "It always seems odd," she wrote, "that countries are never described to you in terms which you recognise when you get there." By 1922, the gagging smell of rotting whale meat had yielded to the more beguiling scent of chocolate from the newly opened Cadbury factory, this mingling in the astoundingly clear air with aromas of warm apricot from Henry Jones's jam emporium. So huge was the demand for Tasmanian jams that part of the reclaimed land on the Hobart Wharf was made up from millions of apricot stones from Jones's factory. Jones named his world-famous produce with the three initials, IXL, short for "In Everything I Excel." His extravagant claim summed up what Agatha Christie felt as she looked around and inhaled the blossom of eucalypts and heartberries. Hobart, she found, incredibly beautiful, with its deep blue sea and harbour, and its flowers, trees and shrubs. I plan to come back and live there one day. Another who had considered putting down roots was Charles Darwin. In February 1836, the Beagle moored in Hobart. Among the passengers to disembark was the 26-year-old naturalist, clamped to his shoulder a small pet monkey. Darwin never forgot the 10 days he spent in Hobart, looking for skinks and digging up rock specimens. If I was obliged to emigrate, I certainly should prefer this place, he wrote. The climate and aspect of the country almost alone would determine me. 18 years on, unable to get Hobart out of his head, he wrote to a friend, the botanist William Hooker. I'm always building veritable castles in the air about emigrating, and Tasmania has been my headquarters of late, so that I feel very proud of my adopted country. In a place as history-obsessed as Tasmania, the present quickly leads back to the past. One of my best friends in Hobart is an architect who lives in the Georgian-style convict-built house where Darwin had celebrated his 27th birthday. At number 17 Secheron Road, Darwin passed what he called his most agreeable evening since leaving England. The one incident to mar his enjoyment was the sudden death of his monkey. Not long ago, my friend Bill was constructing a conservatory when his spade jangled against a strange skull. Bill wrapped the skull up and carried it round the corner to a geologist who told him that he was clutching the remains of a monkey, one that in all probability had belonged to Charles Darwin. While Darwin was chiselling out 260 million-year-old fossils on the top of Mount Wellington, the dominant peak that terminates every view in Hobart, two officers from the Beagle, with less to do, politely offered to check the town's clocks using their chronometers. What they found astonished them. The town was faster than the Beagle by 1 minute and 45 seconds. In other words, for its first 33 years, the established position of Hobart on maps was incorrect by 27 miles. What I like about this story is it accounts for so many things that I have observed and love about the place. Hobart's missing 105 seconds are a paradigm of the idiosyncratic relationship that its citizens appear to enjoy with any clock, and reflect a recent survey which reports an overwhelming and positive impression among an increasing number of visitors that Hobart, or Slobart as people have sometimes called it, is caught up in a bit of a time warp. Because Hobart was so far away, it did its best to be very near. I treasure a locally published history which begins, "For Europeans, it represents the literal end of the world. If you travel any further, you are on your way home again." The Victorian novelist Anthony Trollope, dropping in on the way to visit his Jackaroo son, described it as "more English than is England herself." The town that unfolds below Mount Wellington, nearest landmass to the west, Patagonia, is composed of all too familiar place names: Elizabeth Street, Liverpool Street, Paternoster Row. There's even a real tennis court. Around the corner from Hobart's real tennis court, and opposite the town clock, is Hadley's Hotel, where the Norwegian explorer Amundsen was initially refused entry after returning from his epic journey to the South Pole. "Treated as a tramp, given a miserable little room," he wrote in his diary. Hobart's residents had waved ships off to the ice cap for a century. They were not thunderstruck by Amundsen's achievement, so much as irritated by the barking of his sledge dogs. Even today, there is something unimpressible about Hobartians, as if there is nothing they have not witnessed, no eventuality for which they have not, at some time, prepared themselves, including a Russian invasion. Fortifications erected in panic after the Crimean War are to be found up and down the Derwent River. But despite the presence of these curious stone battlements, Hobart still feels more like a large English market town than a nervous outpost on the edge of the world. Mark Twain, on a lecture tour in 1895, thought it "the neatest town that the sun shines on, and I incline to believe that it is also the cleanest." This remains true. I never stop marvelling at the exceptional clarity of the sunlight. Lack of pollution is one reason given for the fierce Tasmanian light. The island's air is the purest, officially, in the world, cleansed by winds that hurtle in from Tierra del Fuego, 9,000 miles away. By day, it is common to see double rainbows arcing in a dolphin's leap over the rooftops. At night, the strange throbbing emerald pulse of an aurora australis. Mainlanders put the transparency down to the frazzled ozone layer. But whatever the cause, the light is so clear and overexposed that there seems no gauze between it and the first settlers, not to mention the aborigines they dispossessed and cruelly eradicated. The area today occupied by Hobart, the name of a forgotten Secretary of State for the colonies, was originally called Librala-Wagina, but that was only one of its aboriginal names. A friend who claims Tasmanian aboriginal blood, Greg Lehman, says that the local tribes use different names for one place, depending on the season, the time of day, or the context in which it was talked about. The concept seems strange to those chained to the Western, linear, cartographic tradition. You have to imagine it. But that becomes unusually easy to do in Hobart. Put it another way. There have always been even more ways to define Hobart than there are people currently living there. 200,000 at the present count. In fact, I can think of few towns more individual. Hobart's dimensions are human and graspable. According to its light or mood, it can be hideous, boring, twee, daggy. It can exasperate and depress. Read the statistics in the Hobart Mercury. It is Australia's poorest capital. It has Australia's lowest standard of oral hygiene, the highest divorce and suicide rates. But it also has the highest percentage of dog owners, boat owners, and natural scientists. It is charming in the best way, unexpected, tender, eccentric, and irreducibly its own self. This former whaling town knows that it lies at the end of the line, but nor does it forget that the end of the line is closest to the hook, and that from the remotest depths do you draw up the largest and most interesting catch. A flourishing example is the new art museum, the vision of one Hobart citizen, which is sending, as they say, ripples through the international art world. David Welsh is a professional gambler who has consecrated his fortune to building a £70 million art gallery devoted to work celebrating the twin themes of sex and death. Open to the public have responded in huge numbers, and so have critics from New York to London. Welsh's ambition is to curate an exhibition at the Royal Academy in Piccadilly. It is a satisfying prospect, the idea of sophisticated Londoners getting their cultural illumination from Hobart and queuing to look at art from the British Empire's former cesspit. Charles Darwin, who wanted to end his days there, like his pet monkey, would have viewed it as a true example of evolution.